This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Happening, the story of the clean energy revolution. We are beginning tonight a bit differently than we usually do. We're going to give you a sample scene from the Redford Center documentary Happening.
Well, let's talk about marches. Marches are on my mind. I have a strange thing. I find marches really embarrassing.
The title here is in New York City.
So, yeah, here we are in New York. People's Climate March, supposed to be one of these historic moments with this whole climate business. I have no idea what it's going to be like.
Like a lot of people, I just don't know how in the heck I'm supposed to have anything to do with, like, meaningful action around climate change. And, you know, I spent a lot of time talking and harassing people about it, but I haven't done jack myself.
Let's just bring up the awareness somewhat, but this is a good moment. Because here we are doing this, and I see right now a longer line of people waiting for their new iPhones over here, the Apple Store, right? And that's where the parade's going to be, and it's completely empty. You're waiting for the iPhone 6?
Yeah.
Are you going to get the 6 or the 6X?
6.
You're listening to James Redford tell the story.
So I do yoga pretty regularly, and so I'm open to it all. But I just have to say, when I walk upon the scene that's behind me, it's just, this is the sort of image that makes the average American want to hurl, you know? And it's just too bad, because everyone behind me is like really good people, and they're disciplined, and they're really trying to do the right thing, and they are for themselves. But as a cultural image, and like the kind of image that can help move this bar forward, I highly question the value of what's happening behind me. So that's the reality of my take on this. A little bit more energy going on down here.
Yeah, just touch the screen.
Yeah,
just touch the screen. Don't touch it. No, keep it this way.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's more people than I thought there would be. It's interesting though, like the vibe is very positive. It's not an angry crowd.
We're a radical group.
You are?
Yeah.
What's so radical about you?
Well, we advocate for a separate hypothetical militant underground to actually carry out direct actions against industrial infrastructure.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Hey, habitat animal, come here. How's it going today?
It's a bad, bad day for polar bears.
Yeah, it is. And it's probably pretty hot in there.
There's some serious method acting going on right now.
I find that there's often a disconnect. Like, people say they're green and interested in sustainability, but they still drive everywhere.
Yeah,
and
like
they,
me.
And they make thousands of copies at work. And yeah. Also,
Sandy was that wake-up call to us as New Yorkers to say climate change is actually a real issue that we have to deal with.
We were aware of it, but we didn't take it as seriously as we should have.
I think
we're in the middle of an explosion right now.
Babe.
We don't even realize
it's already happened. Listen, Walmart, Google, Apple, Crayola, Johnson & Johnson, all of these companies have moved to 100% renewable energy, not because they necessarily care about climate change, although I think in their hearts they do,
yeah. But
because they see it's economically better for them.
The fact that the Congress is deadlocked on everything does not mean that the United States or the world is deadlocked.
That's so true. It seems like everybody's waiting at the gates. It's like there's this last remnant.
They'll be the last people.
The last. Yeah. A lot more different crowds here from different communities than I thought there would be. Well, I'll tell you something. You know, you see something like this and see all the commitments that organizations are willing to make in organizing for something like this, all the human energy that's gone on to something like this. And then I'm like, really? I can't turn my thermostat from 72 to 68?
Of all ages, all colors, all genders, all sexualities.
People just care about it, you know? It's like, that's the vibe. It's like the frustration of feeling powerless, which is what we all feel. It's an outlet, which is cool. I don't know. It's like completely different than I thought it would be. I've been humbled.
Our narrator for the audience and for the people who are listening was James Redford, and it was 400,000 people, James?
I think it was closer to
500,000. And
well, a lot of people never even made it close to the march.
Right, and all about climate. And when was it done? When was the march?
It was September 21st of last year.
September 21st of last year. Yeah. So we've come a long way. We've come really to a very important point as far as I'm concerned and what's happening in climate. And on that note, let me tell you, it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator tonight, Jill Tidman, who's the producer of Happening and executive director of the Redford Center. And she's going to introduce you to our panel. Jill?
Thank you, Anne. Can you hear me? So sitting next to me, you all just met James Redford. He, as Anne said, he is the chair of the board of the Redford Center. He's the director, producer, and the star of our Happening project. Jamie writes, directs, and produces for film and television. His latest directorial project, Paper Tigers, released this summer. It's excellent. And is currently, we're in production on Happening. In the last two decades, he's written, directed, or produced over a dozen films, including the award-winning HBO documentaries Toxic Hot Seat and Man v. Ford, and the Redford Center's award-winning feature, Watershed. Jamie co-founded the Redford Center with his father in 2005 as a vehicle to make documentaries that inspire positive change. To Jamie's right is Emily Kirsch. She is the co-founder and CEO of Powerhouse, a Bay Area incubator and accelerator for solar entrepreneurs. Formerly, she worked with President Obama's advisor Van Jones at the Ella Baker Center and launched and led the Green Jobs Corps, the Climate Action Coalition, and the Oakland Solar Mosaic Pilot. She's the author of Making Green Work and Creating Climate Action in Your Community and is on the New Leaders Council and the Young Climate Leaders. She is a Young Climate Leaders Fellow. To the right of Emily is Adam Browning. He's the executive director of Vote Solar. Vote Solar is a nonprofit organization with the mission of bringing solar energy into the mainstream. Adam co-founded Vote Solar after working on the successful campaign for San Francisco's 2001 solar bond, and since then has been working with state and municipal governments on pro-solar policies with the goal of jumpstarting the national transition to renewable energy. Prior to Vote Solar, Adam spent 8 years with the EPA, where he won the agency's top pollution prevention award for developing a program that reduced air emissions of mercury. Those are your panelists. So I'm excited to be guiding this conversation. It's a conversation that's very important to me and to the Redford Center. And I think what you'll find at the end of this evening, you'll feel more encouraged, maybe hopefully, than you are at this moment about what's happening in the clean energy sector. I'm going to start us off by asking Jamie to tell us what stories are out there that we aren't hearing. Right now, I think we can all agree, no matter what your position is on climate and energy, that there's some real communication challenges. The polarization, as well as the pessimism that is pervasive in the mainstream media today. I know from doing this film project that there's a lot more out there that we aren't hearing. So I'm going to let the panelists tell us a little bit about that, starting with Jamie.
Well, you know, when we decided to look at, you know, the first conversation we had when we finished Watershed, our last project, was what are we going to do next? And the issue around climate was just looming, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. We started a conversation, and we started to look at it, and it became clearer that sort of in terms of storytelling and messaging, that this shock and awe approach to, you know, ringing the alarm bell around climate change was being more than well covered by any number of really excellent storytellers, filmmakers, and at the same time, we were starting to feel like perhaps that message was beginning to fall on deaf ears because of the way, you know, overexposure to sort of a message of hopelessness and despair just desensitizes people. And I think the way this conversation is moribund right now in our culture is a result of a number of things, but one of them is that it's asking a lot for people to think about something which you're also conveying hopelessness. So for us, it was like, well, is there hope? What's going on? And what we saw in the landscape, not only there was an interesting parallel, because as you saw with Al Gore's graph, which has this, you know, this startling sort of upward curvature of concern, you also saw the same graph in terms of the development of renewable energy here and abroad. The graphs were almost identical. So in a way, the solution and that which we can feel hopeful about is going through the same sort of, you know, not alarming trend, but exciting trend as we're trying to comprehend the changes that are coming our way. And then equally more interesting, and when we really decided the film was worth making, was when we realized that this was playing out in a way that was not your typical landscape for environmental messaging. I think, you know, typically speaking, you ask the average American, what is an environmentalist and who cares about the environment and who's working around issues with the environment? And the profile comes up very liberal, very elite, very highly educated, perhaps other means of income. I mean, the profile is there, and historically there is intuit to it. But when it comes to renewables, it's just not true. I mean, you're seeing this thing play out. I can tell any number of stories. For instance, the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, right? He's going to have the Navy 50% renewable in the next 3 years. You know, the Navy, because oil is a bummer to them. They don't want to send soldiers to protect oil lines. That's one of the number one security threats to their ability to do what they do, is having to worry about the supply line. So there are strategic disadvantages. And if you talk to him, you will get a sense that perhaps, you know, oil is not worth sending our young, brave men off to fight for. So you've got the Navy going, and down there in San Diego, you've got in Utah, you've got a startup company in Utah being led by a bunch of ex-Mormon missionaries, Republicans from the reddest county in the reddest state in America, who are killing it in third-party solar, Vivint Solar, because they know how to sell things. Because most of these guys are returned missionaries. And if you can sell the Book of Mormon, you can sell renewable energy. So it's awesome. And you've got in Buffalo, New York, of all places, you have one of the Solar City is currently building the best solar panels in the world, as many people say. Not maybe the most compared to China, but the best. And it's hard industry, hard, good jobs, a real change happening in Buffalo in terms of the community. You've also got activists there that are incorporating renewables into what it means to have a healthy community for challenged communities. You've got, I mean, I could just go on. I mean, the stories are sort of endless. You've got Apple, who just sort of nonchalantly says, oh yeah, we cover all of our operations are covered by offsetting renewables, 100%. And you ask them, well, why aren't you trumpeting us out there in the world? And they say, oh, well, you know, we're Apple. We're always ahead of things. It's just who we are. So the corporate world is changing. I mean, the stories go on and on. The bottom line is, that old notion of who's making this change has gone away, and it's gone away because of economics and technology coming together to create new opportunities and offer real hope.
And Emily, what are you seeing with the entrepreneurs that you're supporting? What are the stories that you feel like aren't getting covered, or the the moments that you would love for people to know about that you get to see?
Definitely. I'd say I want to start by saying we're winning. If it's a question of whether solar's winning or not, we are. But I want to take a, and I'll tell you why, but I want to take a poll first. So just a show of hands, if you consider yourself an optimist, if you could raise your hands. Optimist. Okay, that's great. I think that's pretty much everyone in the room. If you're not, I hope to convince you to be by the end of the discussion. And we have good reason to be. From jobs to investments to innovation to entrepreneurship, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. On the jobs front, another poll. So show of hands, who you think employs more people in the U.S.? Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter combined, or the solar industry? So show of hands for Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter. Okay, a couple, like 10 maybe, and show of hands for the solar industry. You're right. Not a trick question. So the solar industry actually employs more people than Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter combined today. So that's exciting. When you compare solar to fossil fuel, the jobs growth in the solar industry is 8 times that of coal, oil, and gas combined. When you look at economic growth, anyone know how much the economy grew last year in the U.S.? About 2.4, between 1 and 2.5%. Solar industry grew 20%. So 20 times the growth that the national economy had, we saw 20 times that in the solar industry. So at Powerhouse, we're all about supporting that innovation and growth by helping entrepreneurs succeed. So we're completely dedicated to solar startups and connecting them to the investors, the industry leaders, the mentors that they need to grow and scale their business. And I think solar's for everyone. You know, when I say solar, most of us probably think of panels, which isn't wrong, but it's changing. Whatever you do in your career, whether you're in, you know, if you're a lawyer or you're in finance or you're a teacher, there's a role for you to play in the solar industry. It's no longer just about installations on roofs. From an investment perspective, we're also seeing tremendous value. Today, the solar industry is worth $250 billion globally annually. So this is not just your, you know, kind of hippie pipe dream anymore. According to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, by 2040, so in 25 years, the solar industry will be worth not $100 billion or $500 billion, it'll be worth $3.7 trillion. $2.2 trillion of that is in distributed systems, so not centralized systems out in the desert, but on our homes and on our schools and on our community centers. And $1 trillion of that is going to be in places that have never had electricity. So this is completely game-changing, and this is big money. From an innovation perspective, you know, we've seen a lot of changes in the peer economy or the share economy. You know, Airbnb, worth $20 billion, has disrupted hotels. Uber, worth $50 billion, has disrupted transportation. We're going to see that kind of disruption in energy. This century-old centralized energy infrastructure that we haven't had a choice in is going to change, and it's going to change because entrepreneurs are going to disrupt it. And we deserve that choice. The same way we have choice in the food that we eat, we should have that kind of choice with the energy that we consume. And when given the choice, people are going to choose renewables. The bad news is technology is not going to save us. It's not. There's no silver bullet. But the good news is people are. And when that kind of innovation is supported, that's when we can experience the kind of change that we all believe in. And so I think the question is, who is going to change the world? Is it going to be the Exxons of the world? And Exxon, as you may have heard, is currently being investigated by the New York Attorney General for denying and lying to the public about the impacts of climate change and its effects on their investors. Or is it going to be entrepreneurs? And we argue that it's entrepreneurs. It's not that utilities are wrong or less smart. It's just that by the time you can establish a program with a utility, it might take 10 years. And in that same amount of time, SolarCity has incorporated, hired 14,000 people, owns 40% of the residential market share in the solar industry, and is worth $2.7 billion. So I think the lesson there is that entrepreneurs, people who are excited about getting into energy, I don't hear a lot of people say, I can't wait to join a utility, which, again, it's not wrong if you're joining a utility, but I do hear entrepreneurs say, I can't wait to start a business. I can't wait to change the world. I can't wait to put my skills as a developer or a designer or a programmer to use in supporting the greatest opportunity that our generation has to make a difference in the world. So as far as entrepreneurs, I have the best job in the world and just get to work. We have 20 solar startups in-house, 200 entrepreneurs. We've had 3 exits in the past 12 months, and we're just getting started.
Wow. Thank you, Emily. Adam, I'm wondering, you've been at this for a really long time. Are there moments that have happened along the way that you wish had gotten more coverage, or things that were turning points for you that you've seen real change happening, the tide changing?
Definitely. So I run Vote Solar. We're a nonprofit that focuses on policy change, on making the rules right, developing sustainable solar markets. And when we started, the conversation really was about how do we make solar cheap? That was the biggest barrier. And that was back in 2002. And we had a guide that was provided by, actually, Greenpeace had commissioned a report from KPMG, an accounting firm, that estimated that once you got enough scale to meet 500 megawatts worth of solar demand, that we would get to this grid parity, that solar would be cheaper than fossil fuels. And that was really just the guideline, the blueprint that we worked off of. You needed to build scale in order to reduce costs. And honestly, the hippies were right. It actually did work just like that. So we've really, you know, we are winning. We are not won yet. It's still, there's a lot of vulnerability to the momentum that we've made. I do believe success will ultimately come. But yeah, if you had asked me that, would I think that I was going to spend my 30s and a lot of my 40s just arguing over arcane utility policies and regulatory forums? No, that was not the initial plan. But that's where the real battles were. And California actually has a lot to be proud of. A lot of this has been pioneered here. And so, you know, if you think about it, actually, maybe you haven't thought about it. It's really kind of opaque. It's hard to see. There were times this summer when the entire state was over 50% renewable, over 30% solar, and a third of that just from rooftops. So you've got the seventh, eighth largest economy in the world run on hippie pipe dreams. And, you know, it's really awesome to see. Like, you know, you know, if you can dream it, you can make it happen.
Thank you. So if we're winning, but we haven't won, where are we in this moment in history? I mean, we're coming into an election year. We've been seeing the president taking a more vocal, definitive position on things. How important is that to the industry?
You know, energy really is a choice. Policy sort of delivers the outcomes that we see. There is no free market when it comes to energy out there. I think this president has been committed to trying to see, in effect, a reversal of the free pass to pollute our atmosphere and not be able to account for that in the costs when you generate your electricity. You know, he's had to work with Congress. We have a saying around the office, if your plan involves Congress, it's a bad plan. So which is really why we stick with state level policy, where we see the real leadership happen. And so you've got here a governor in California that's been committed to it. This year, the legislature passed, really do a lot to give a lot of credit to Governor Brown and his leadership, a bill to have 50% renewables by 2030. That's not that far away. We're already at somewhere around 26-27%. The utilities are contracted to at least 33%. So this is a point at which, you know, alternative energy isn't really the alternative anymore. I mean, it's the fossil fuels that are the alternative. You know, the renewable energy is in fact becoming quite the mainstay. So, yes, it's quite vulnerable at a state level. There's a lot of pressure from some utilities to unwind some of the progress that's been made and make it a lot harder for renewables to get access to the grid, to get valued. And just yesterday, the Senate voted to undo the Clean Power Plan, this whole idea that there should be a limit on carbon, that you should have to factor that into power plant choices. So the future, you know, the presidential election will determine whether we continue to go forward or whether we unwind a lot of these gains. The stakes couldn't really be higher.
Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, the COP 21 coming up in Paris with all of these other countries coming into the fold. I'd love to hear from you guys. Where do you think, where's the rest of the world on this issue? I mean, we know a lot from where we work. It's happening in the U.S., and it is encouraging. Where else is there a lot of traction on this, and where isn't there?
I would say, just given in light of what's happening in the world right now, it's a heavy time. Not that it's never not, but, you know, in Beirut, in Syria, and Paris, the connection to climate change might not be obvious, but there is a direct connection. And, you know, the original drought in Syria that led to the agricultural collapse, that led to the migration into the cities, it's, you can tie it back to climate change. And so as far as what happens at COP in Paris, and it is moving forward, it couldn't be more important, because energy security is not endless wars that we've been fighting for decades. It is decentralized and distributed and democratized energy on every home and every community in every part of the world. That's energy security. And so I think the conversation in Paris gives us an opportunity to take that conversation and make it real at a point in time where it couldn't be more important given what's happening.
Well put. I'd just like to add a little something to this. You know, for a long time, there's a lot of discussion, debate, like, okay, you know, America shouldn't take the lead because what about China? What about India? They're building so much coal. Well, you know, coal usage in China is actually going down. China has already committed to building in the next 15 years a grid of adding an amount of renewables to their grid equivalent to the entire capacity for power generation in the U.S. Take what the U.S. does, turn it all renewable, they've already committed to that. India has passed a bill that requires 40% of their electricity come from renewables, and solar is quickly becoming cheaper than coal in India as well. So, you know, we're running out of excuses for not taking a leadership role. Like, other countries are jumping far ahead. I'm particularly gravitated towards and enthralled by the power for renewables, and particularly solar, to provide power for places and people who have never had electricity ever at all. Bangladesh, they're selling, it's about 10% solarized already. They're selling between 50 and 60,000 solar systems a month there. We can have a huge discussion about Africa as well. But there's about 1.3 billion people in this world without access to electricity. And there's huge innovation in these business models that take this resource that is, frankly, fuel delivered free to every area in the globe until the relevant end of time, and utilizing it to give power to people who have never had access to electricity ever before.
This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Happening, the Story of the Clean Energy Revolution. Our moderator is Jill Tidman, producer of Happening and executive director of the Redford Center. She is joined by James Redford, director of Happening and chair of the board, the Redford Center, Emily Kirsch, co-founder and CEO of Powerhouse, and you just heard Adam Browning, the executive director, Vote Solar. Thanks very much. Jill?
Thanks, Ann. So one thing I wanted to share about Happening is that it is an HBO film that will air next year. And the way the Redford Center does our work is every film that we produce an impact campaign. So stay tuned, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, whatever you do, keep up with us, because we'll be launching in the spring and would love to have you be part of what we're doing. So as a producer on the project, one of the highlights for me was going to the California ISO, the grid operators up in Folsom. I'm not supposed to say that. and they were running, the day that we were there, they were running, I think, 33 or 34% renewable power. And we were talking to them about, you know, the targets that Governor Brown had said. And they said, well, 2 years ago, we were running 10%. We're going to blow those targets away. And it was one of the moments I'll never forget of all the things we did and all the people we met. It was very real. I'd love to hear from you guys. And Jamie, maybe you could kick us off. You know, what are some of the stories? What are some of the people that that sort of have really made an impression on you and given you some hope for the future?
Well, I had the pleasure of going to Georgetown, Texas, which is a little community about 60,000 north of Austin by about 45 minutes. The mayor of Georgetown, Texas, Dale Ross, Republican, presides over a predominantly Republican town council. And yet, he just signed power purchase agreements for wind power that will take this little town 100% renewable by the end of next year. And of course, when I heard that, I just jumped on the plane. Who is this guy? And you go to talk to him, and you know, for me, it was just a beautiful thing. When my takeaway was, it was so logical to hear him explain why they did this, and it was just a matter of two things from his point of view: price stability and price affordability. Simple stuff. Texas, the grid there is uniquely well situated to take wind power generated from great distances and pour it into, so to speak. I usually talk about electricity metaphorically as if it's water, because it's so confusing. One of the many sort of foibles in this film is me actually trying to educate myself about what electricity is, how you generate, transmit, and consume it. And I'm sort of putting myself on the cross on behalf of the American public, because most of us don't have the time to understand this stuff. It's highly complicated. But in spite of these complexities, the town is very proud and excited to be a renewable energy town right smack in the middle of oil country. And you know, to hear him talk about it, you realize that people, if you just give them the right opportunity, they'll do the right thing. People don't wake up in the morning thinking, wow, I want to do something really nasty. You know, I mean, I can't wait to put more carbon into the atmosphere. That just really, you know, sends me wild. I mean, come on. So, you know, and I think what you see in the case of the mayor is that, you know, we are nearing a point where people are going to be able to make better decisions. And that's really exciting.
Thank you.
So I'm excited about the scale at which renewables and solar in particular are being adopted. And so to that point, another poll question. Anyone know how often a solar system is being installed in the U.S.? Like every day, every hour? Any ideas? Every hour, every minute. So somewhere in between. So it's every 2.5 minutes. Every 2.5 minutes in the U.S., a solar system is going on a home in the U.S. It'll be every 80 seconds by 2016. And a show of hands, who has solar in the room? Anyone? Awesome. That's great. That's about 10 people or so.
More than one.
So the first thing you have to do when you go solar is the solar company needs 12 months of your utility bills. And that helps them assess how much energy you're using so that they can size the system appropriately and know how many panels to put on your roof. As it is now, in order to get that data, you have to get it from your utility, in our case, PG&E. And that process is surprisingly, well, or not so surprisingly, bureaucratic and slow and difficult. And there's a woman named Alina Lucas, who's the co-founder and CEO of a company in Powerhouse called Utility API. And she worked at PG&E. And she saw firsthand how, when people, customers of PG&E wanted to go solar, how difficult it was for them to get access to their own bills in order to facilitate the process of them going solar. So she decided to leave her job at PG&E to start this company to make it easy and seamless for people to get their data out of the utilities and into the hands of the solar company so that they can help this person go solar. And when she started, it was just her and her co-founder. That was about a year ago. They have a dozen employees now, and they have customers that you may have heard of, companies like SolarCity and Tesla. So going from, you know, a year where she's just part of the utility system to having her own startup that's been funded at least a couple million, I don't know the exact number, but it's been incredible to watch her growth coming from her personal experience and having the drive and passion and willing to take the risk, because we know that the risk of failure is worth it. We're going to do it anyway, because the risk of doing nothing is so much greater than the risk of trying and failing. And she and Utility API are a great example of that.
Great. Adam?
Yeah, I'll take us in a slightly different direction. I mean, it's just an exciting time to be alive. Like, the pace of change and the consequences of it are amazing. I'm going to take us back to Africa, where there's just, it's a huge continent with many countries, and there's a lot of people there that have no access at all to electricity. I'm on the advisory board of a company called Phoenix International, and they've a solar panel, battery, and a little bit of communication device with that as well. So instead of selling a solar panel and a battery with the lantern jacks and the cell phone rechargers, they have a lease-to-own model that's all enabled by mobile money. And now they have partnerships with local cell phone companies in Uganda and are really creating solar entrepreneurs there, where they have people who end up leasing these. They 28 cents a day opens the battery, and you get about 8 cell phone charges out of that battery after it's charged up with solar. And from that, they end up sort of reselling cell phone charging 25 cents a day. They do two. They're already in the black. So it's just seeing that kind of explosion in entrepreneuriality, not just here in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, but around the world, that delivers real and concrete good, just blows my mind. I love it.
Thank you. I think, and I don't know if I'm the only one in the room that thinks about this, but sometimes when I hear these stories and I see what's happening in the industry, it leaves me wondering, what can I do? And I would love to know from you guys, of all the things you've seen and experienced and know are happening, what can the individual consumer do, and what's the most potent thing that we can do?
Well, you know, I think you mentioned before, you know, where is the sweet spot for change? And I think, you know, one of the things for me, this is just speaking for me, is that, you know, you can look at your own situation, your own profile, whatever your socioeconomic profile is, what you can afford to do, where you're at, and there's a way to connect to renewable energy. Sometimes it's going to be easier than others. And I think if you're in a situation where even, you know, we now know that the third-party leasing is far more affordable than most of the public thinks it is. However, if that's, you know, if you don't have roof space and, you don't have a house, which a lot of people don't meet that criteria, then your community can band together and create the demand as a group that can trigger the right installation of renewables. And then, so at the community level, you know, my feeling is that as an individual, if you can afford to have a third-party lease, if you don't want to pay for that stuff up front, it's an easier thing to have a third-party lease financially. If you can afford to do it, it's a really big move to do. And if you can't, then there are all kinds of ways in which we can now aggregate clusters of communities to make purchases of power. And clearly that's what's happening in Marin County, where I live. We have, you know, a sort of alternative to PG in terms of procuring our power. It relies right now a little too much, in my opinion, on the purchasing of renewable energy credits, which is a certificate, or a certificate it is, I think, renewable energy certificates. They are transitional. They are meant to spur the growth of the energy providers. But essentially, I think they will go away in time. And that, you can go online, and your community can do it. You don't need to wait for Congress. And mayors are phenomenal on this level, as I said. Across the political spectrum, communities can if it's affordable, they can do it. So, you know, I think there are definitely options.
As much as I love my solar facts, I know facts don't change people. People change people. So as far as if you hear something exciting tonight that you didn't know before, just sharing it with somebody else is probably more powerful than any statistic I could say or anyone could share. So I'd say that's the first and foremost thing that you could do, is just have a conversation with somebody about it and think about how renewables could fit into your life. And if it's not on your own home, then through community solar, which is where people can collectively own part of a solar system and get renewable energy for your home without having to actually put it on your own roof. And then I would say there's been a pretty great conversation developed around divesting, and then investing, and the divestment movement from the university level to university endowments to pension funds is taking a close look at fossil fuel, because if you've been tracking it, coal is in the graveyard. You know, you can't even short coal. You can't even bet on its failure anymore because it's too expensive because everyone's doing it. And so there's been this tremendous movement to move money out of fossil fuel, with coal in particular, because it's risky for the pension funds that have trillions of dollars invested in fossil fuel. It's clear that that's not working, and it's not going to work in the future. And then the flip side of that is, well, where does that money go? And in the case of our work at Powerhouse supporting solar entrepreneurs, it goes into innovators. It goes into entrepreneurs that are taking the risk and building the businesses that are going to get us to 100% renewable energy. So I'd say, as far as individuals go, it's something that I've looked at a lot for where I can put my money where my mouth is and feel good about the investments that I'm making, whether it's retirement or whatever other funds you have.
Great. It's a great question. And before I answer it, I just want to, yesterday there was a vote in the UK and they are getting off of coal. This is the metaphor for ubiquity. Bringing coal to Newcastle has decided, no, don't bring any more coal to Newcastle. It's we're done with this. That just kind of blew my mind. But I'm going to answer this slightly differently, which is, get political. You poll America, and we do. Super majorities of Americans want to see this transition to renewable energy. Yet, despite our name, Vote Solar, it's very difficult to vote for solar. A lot of these decisions are happening inside of regulatory bodies, at state governments. They're not pulled out into the sunshine. You need to get involved. You need to make your desires and wishes known at the right time. So you can join, not to say advertisement here, but this is what we exist to do, is to connect people with the right decisions. When those things happen, you can join Vote Solar on our website, and we will help make that connection. This has been a lot about solar, but let me just throw out as well, electric vehicles are awesome. We know how to decarbonize electricity. Decarbonizing transportation has been much more difficult. You know, it wasn't so long ago that electric vehicles just really didn't exist. Now, every manufacturer of vehicles has an electric line, and then some of the most exciting ones are brand new, only electric vehicles. You know, you plug that into your solar system, you're running on sunshine. You are never buying fuel again in your life, which kind of blows my mind. Beyond this, there's a new relationship between you and utilities as well. So one of the challenges of running a grid on a lot of variable renewables is the fact that they're kind of variable. Storage, batteries are a huge solution to this. With the right policies, if you have millions of new electric vehicles, they can play a huge role into helping to stabilize that grid. So right now, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, and BMW have a pilot program where, if you will allow the utility to control, have a say in when you charge your electric vehicle, they will pay you $1,500 a year. Used to be you would have a car that you would have to pay to fill up with poison. Now you have a car that pays you money while it's parked in your garage. The future is going to be awesome.
And I will also mention that, you know, some other benefits, you know, apologies to the California Highway Patrol. These are fast cars. They were really fun to drive.
Somebody owns a Tesla.
And they get you in the commuting lane. So, you know, I almost don't want to share that secret because it's getting a little crowded in that commuting lane.
So this is a San Francisco event here, and I know that a couple months ago I was trying to figure out what's going on in San Francisco. What are my options as a homeowner here? Do any of you know much about Clean SF, the initiative that's coming early next year?
So Jamie had spoke about this idea of, in California, communities can come together and decide that they want to have more control over their power choices. And so San Francisco is trying to do just that, pull that together, an option where you will not just get your power from the investor-owned utility, but you will have community choice. This whole option is called community choice aggregation, and so that's in development as far as I can tell at this point. So it's
coming. Just one other thing I'd like to say is that I got so excited when I saw these market forces at play, and as I was learning, because honestly, I'm a filmmaker first. I care about the environment. I make films around these issues, but that doesn't necessarily, as you can see in the movie, that doesn't make me a Puritan, even if I wanted to be one. And you know, when I got swept up in the frenzy of, wow, the market force is going to take care of this whole situation. You know, capitalism is actually going to be okay. You know, it was this exciting period, and then that sort of faded because of my realization that it's just the problem is the market forces will make all this happen. It will, for sure. The question is how rapidly. And the real factor is time. And the time is what we don't have. We can't do anything about that. You know, the only thing we can do is accelerate what we already see is working. And when I hear something like the investment tax credit, you know, going, which allows investment in renewables, you know, elapsing in a year and a half, the idea that that's even possible, it's very frustrating because we're already doing something there that's really working. It's already happening. But, you know, grassroots has to push policy. It's going to come from the grassroots because that's where this is all playing out, and it's going to get up there, and it's going to end up in D.C., and we're going to live to see this change.
Amen.
Thank you, Jamie. Let's stay on that topic for a second. We have a great audience question about the investment tax credit for Adam. Someone is interested in knowing what is the future of the investment tax credit.
Yeah, that's
a good
response. That's
a sad
response.
Sound of, yeah. of yeah. everybody's.
I was wondering if that's my daughter. No, okay. Well, that's actually the sound I often make when I'm asked that question. remember what I said about Congress and plans thereof? So, honestly, you know, you're going to need Congress. So, we have a current policy that there's a 30% investment tax credit that really, so your solar is, you get a 30% off sale, which is awesome. It is doing exactly what it was supposed to do, which was build scale to reduce costs. And that is scheduled to expire at the end of 2016. All the tax credits and tax breaks that the fossil fuel industry gets, coincidentally enough, they never sunset. They're hardwired in. You know, there's a lot of work going on to try to make sure that this gets attached to the bills that have to go through. It's a crafty strategy, but there is nothing more potent than popular opinion, than people saying that this is important to them. So I can't emphasize this too much. Let your elected officials know that this is important to you and that you want to see solutions, not just talk.
This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Happening, the Story of the Clean Energy Revolution. With Jill Tidman, who's producer of Happening, and our moderator tonight, Jill is also executive director of the Redford Center. We also include in our wonderful panel James Redford, director of Happening and chair of the board of the Redford Center, Emily Kirsch, co-founder and CEO of Powerhouse, and Adam Browning, executive director of Vote Solar. And now we've come to that point in our evening that we have audience questions. And Jill will be giving you the questions that we've gotten, and we will ask the panel for their responses. Jill?
Thank you, Anne. So we do have an audience question about should solar be subsidized?
Yes. I mean, it's the question of do we care about our future or not? You know, do we want to continue to support the stuff that has gotten us to where we are in the situation that we're in, or do we want to support the stuff that's going to get us to 100% renewable? I think it's an obvious question or an obvious answer. And there's a group, I don't know if you've heard of them, they're called the Green Tea Party. It's like the Tea Party, but green. And they call for removing all subsidies. They're like, just don't, if we really do have a quote unquote free market and the market's really going to speak for itself, then just get rid of all of them. And if we did that, then we'd have grid parity, meaning the cost of renewables would be more affordable than fossil fuel today. So I'd say yes, and if we're going to not subsidize solar or renewables, then don't subsidize any of it.
Yeah, let me just add a slight refinement to that point, which is, you know, the solar industry has always viewed incentives and subsidies as a means to an end, not the end in and of itself. And so here in California, we had a very successful state-level program of incentivizing in a market-based way solar installations. You know, it had declining incentives that went down to zero. They went down to zero earlier this year. You know how many bills there were to, like, reintroduce that subsidy? Zero. Stuck by our promises. Brought down costs, didn't go back to the table. The fossil fuel industry can't say the same. So, I agree. Get rid of them all or, you know, level the playing field.
What do you all think about the current controversy of the net metering issue? So maybe someone can explain net metering before we get into that.
Sure. So net metering is a policy that says if you have a solar panel on your roof and you have any excess electricity that you're not using, you can feed it back into the grid and get fair credit for it. Seems pretty straightforward. So right now we have that program here in California. We have it in about 46, 47 states around the country, and we're under attack everywhere. Utilities are trying to unwind this and ensure that you don't actually get value for the solar that you put on your rooftop. So this is a decision before the California Public Utilities Commission right now, where they are trying to decide whether we keep this current system or whether we make radical changes. Some utilities have proposed some very destructive changes to this policy. By the end of the year, we're hoping to have a solution to it. So,
Okay, thank you. This is a question for Emily. Are your entrepreneurial companies evolving PV technology?
Yes. So PV meaning photovoltaics, which is distinct from solar thermal, which is solar hot water. All of ours are exclusively PV. But when we say solar, we also include all of the auxiliary services that are necessary for solar to be successful. And that means, Adam mentioned storage. When people ask what's the next big thing in solar, it's not actually solar, it's storage, it's batteries. And we've seen that with Tesla's announcement with what they call the Powerwall, which is their very sleek-looking battery that they've introduced. That are on back order. Jamie, I don't know if you've put in your order yet, but that's a huge part of solar demand response, meaning what Adam was talking about, where you can, if you are producing solar, when does it go to your home versus go to your car versus go back to the grid, and how do you maximize the production and the value of that system? So yes, our entrepreneurs work in all of those spaces, but we've seen this incredible crash in the cost of hardware, the stuff that you can hold, like panels and inverters. The cost of panels alone has dropped between 80 and 90% in the past 5 years. So the cost of the hardware has gone down significantly. So the interesting thing, for those of you that raise your hands that you have solar, more than 50% of the cost of your system was not actually hardware. It's not the panels and the inverters. It's the soft cost, meaning the permitting, the lead generation, the design, the asset management, the operations. And that's our focus at Powerhouse, is supporting entrepreneurs who are reducing those soft costs, because ultimately that's what's going to drive adoption. The kind of work that Adam was talking about in Africa, where people can pay for solar on a pay-as-you-go basis using your cell phone, you know, that's a technology challenge from a programming standpoint, from a telecom standpoint. And so those are the kinds of skills that entrepreneurs are putting to use in making solar the most abundant and affordable energy resource in the world, which is not a question of if, it's a question of when.
You know, just say last summer I had the pleasure of attending the InterSolar convention here in San Francisco. It was the, you know, solar energy's main gathering of the year at the Moscone Convention Center, which is the size of JFK. And, you know, the most exciting thing about that, it was the two floors, and the thing where the energy was not around the panel or the battery. It was around all these young entrepreneurs that had an angle on how to do it more quickly and more efficiently. And the pitching was fast and furious, and the energy was up, and the competition was stiff, And it was just really exciting to see this whole thing playing out right in front of me that you're describing. Yeah.
This is a question for Adam. Regarding building codes, are there efforts being made to change building codes so that all buildings have to have mounting brackets on all new roofs?
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of places in the world, including Lancaster, California, another town that has a Republican mayor, et cetera, that require new buildings to come with solar. Something like 26% of the new buildings in California last year came with solar already. So, you know, people are already seeing the value proposition without the heavy hand of government, although certain localities have done this. France actually passed a law. You either put a green roof, i.e. Grow plants on it, or you have PV on your roof for new buildings. So either photosynthesis or photovoltaics, you take your pick. So, you know, those are the kind of laws, though, that are difficult at a state level where you do see a lot of parochialism in terms of the local control. So, the first step is really streamlining the solar permitting, which is a lot less sexy, but still radically important.
So this is not directed to anyone in particular, but with hypersolar proving the viability of cheap hydrogen production from any water source, when will investments in hydrogen start?
I'm no hydrogen expert, so I probably shouldn't be talking, but I know, and Adam, you may know a bit about this as well, in Germany, they're producing so much solar and so much renewables that they actually are able to put that into hydrogen. But for us, I think it's a question of the life cycle analysis, the cost of solar production versus hydrogen. And I think solar's winning.
Yeah, that's kind of a little Civil War question you asked there. So I'm going to just step out of it.
Smart man.
All right, we've addressed this to a certain extent already, but what role does divestment play in the emerging role of solar and renewables? How important is it?
You know, honestly, you know, when I first heard about the divestment movement and the parallels to what happened in South Africa, I was a little skeptical. In South Africa, the situation was, you know, we want to divest, and it was very clear what you wanted the South African government to do in order for the pain to stop. The divestment movement, as per fossil fuels, has a less clear end game to me. Yet, I've been blown away by the momentum it's taken and, frankly, the effectiveness it's really had in changing the conversation around the future of fossil fuels. Like, this has really had the endorsement of, you know, for some reason, people that control a lot of wealth seem to really matter more than people that don't. And it has really sort of endorsed this idea that the future does not belong to fossil fuels. And I really think it's having a huge impact.
Great. So do you think solar will be able to grow at the same rates if all the investment tax credits and net metering agreements disappear in the next couple of years?
No. I mean, I think Jamie's right. We're going to win eventually. It's a question of time. Like, we're moving to renewables. Are we going to do it before we take all the fossil fuels that are in the ground and put it in the air? Or are we going to do that first? So, I think we need all the supportive policies possible. We don't have time to mess around.
I'm going to try this. Even if California policymakers have said that energy efficiency and renewables won't be enough to meet the 2 degrees Celsius goal, do you agree? And if so, what will it be?
Go ahead. I think regardless of the degree, we do it anyway. You know, I think of us, you know, in this room and people who care about this work as cathedral builders, and we'll probably never see the final product. And we build it knowing that we won't, but we do it anyway. So whether we get to that or not, we have to live every day like we're going to, but we also have to know that we're probably, you know, we may or may not see it.
I mean, there are so many variables at play in the world, and it is impossible to control from it all. I just think it's directionality, it's movement that matters. Move in the right direction as fast and as hard as you can. You cannot pick a number and say we're going to hit that and then we're going to stop. That's the magic one. Just get to work.
Yeah, and you know, absolutely. And that, you know, it really, in some ways, you're talking about a new kind of faith. You know, when you look at the future, you know, we tend to think of the unknown and uncertainty as a negative thing. But in fact, the flip side of that is possibility. And it's just as powerful. And, you know, you can find articles written by journalists around the turn of the 20th century in which the calamity coming to the humankind was all the horse manure in European capitals, right? The predictions were that we were going to bury ourselves under horse manure. And what were we going to do about all this? Well, nobody saw the car coming. Took care of the horse manure problem. And, you know, I mean, what I'm talking about is we, you know, we have to learn to embrace the possibility as much as the uncertainty. And in my mind, it's a matter of faith. I'm going to go there because the alternative is unacceptable. So.
This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for our last question. And because I'm chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum, guess what? I get to ask that question. This is somewhat of a devil's advocate question. I hear a lot about the potential, and I hear a lot about what's happening economically in the segments you're talking about. But what I don't hear, and what worries me a great deal, is how do we transition all those people who, many of whom have very good skills and low incomes, from coal and gas and other products. How do we transition those who have jobs now and need to continue to have employment? I come out of the civil rights war and poverty movement, so I will let you know by saying this. But I think it's very important that we're not paying attention to the transition period that has to happen if we make this transition, and needs to happen for those who have not lots and lots of money, but people who barely make it now on the money that they're doing from these industries. So I'd like, I'm going to put you on the spot. I'd like each of our panelists to address that. How do we manage that transition?
All right, I'm happy to start. So as exciting as this change is, it's important to know, you know, right now solar comprises about 1% of our overall energy production in this country. So we have a long way to go before we finally put the final stake into coal. Unfortunately, I'd like to accelerate this as much as possible. I'm all for as much efforts and as much money as possible into transitioning the people that are involved in the coal industry, which frankly is not that large when you compare it to the solar industry. I know Emily's got this figure right now, so I'll let her go with it. But, you know, we are creating a much larger economic benefit, and we should do everything possible to make sure that this is a tide that floats all boats. So whether it is, you know, economic redevelopment programs, so those that are phasing out of the buggy whip industry and into the next thing, great, let's do it. Let's not impede progress just to save a job that shouldn't be. So,
I mentioned earlier some of the stats on job creation in the solar industry, and those being jobs growth in solar being 20 times that the national average, jobs creating solar creating jobs at a rate 8 times that of coal, oil, and gas combined. If there are jobs to be had, it's in renewables. It's not in fossil fuel. Those jobs are going away, and I think the transition is so critical for people who have lived and put food on the table as a result of those jobs. And so the kind of work that Adam's talking about, the training programs, the policy work that's necessary for those jobs to enter those states. So when you have political leadership that is denying their own citizens the right to work in renewable energy, that's a human rights abuse. And so the kind of work that Vote Solar is doing is so important, because in order for people that Anne's talking about to transition into renewable jobs, the renewable industry has to be able to operate and grow in that state. And so props to Vote Solar for the work that they're doing. Because the transition is inevitable, but who's going to have access to it and how quickly? But we are seeing solar go from novelty to ubiquity. I'd argue we're still in the novelty phase, but it's the same thing with cell phones. We all remember when cell phones were novel, when they were exclusively for the rich and inaccessible, and we had to learn how to text, and you know, sending your first text was hard, and I had to teach my mom to do it. And but now they're ubiquitous, and they're in all of our pockets, and they're everywhere around the world, and there's better cell phone coverage throughout most of Africa than there is in the US. So it's a question of that transition. And I think the reason why solar is going to continue to win is because it's a technology, it's not a fuel. And so just like a cell phone, as the technology, as manufacturing becomes more efficient, as the technology advances, it gets cheaper and cheaper, more and more people have it. We'll see that with solar. Whereas fossil fuel, it's the exact opposite. It's a finite resource. The less of it, the more expensive it gets. And even if we see these temporary dips, as we're seeing with the price of oil now, it's temporary. Eventually, it runs out and the sun doesn't.
You know, one of the powerful statistics for me is what percentage of new employees in the renewable industry come out of the return vets. There's a disproportionate amount of return vets working, and some of that statistic comes from the private sector itself that has their own programs to invite veterans into their workforce. You think about sort of the irony of what are our young men being sent over to fight for these days, and you can draw it down the oil almost exclusively. The idea that they would come back and embrace something that is sort of the alternative makes more sense than we can even describe. But I am sort of disappointed and somewhat ashamed that we haven't provided more opportunities along these lines, that you send people off to fight for something like oil, and then you better take care of them when they come back. And at least the private sector and the renewable industry is proving a willingness to do that.
Oh. Jill, would you like to comment?
Sure, yeah. I agree with everything that everyone said. And I think there's an opportunity. I mean, for me, where I find power in storytelling and conversation, as Emily mentioned, it's, we're always looking to invite people into this conversation that aren't typically invited to the table. And so that's one of the big strategies we have for our impact campaign, is trying to reach into those communities that maybe don't have this conversation at the dinner table. And I would just encourage all of you to help kind of perpetuate that as much as you can.
Oh, those are all wonderful responses. Thank you so much to the panel. This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Happening, the Story of the Clean Energy Revolution. Our moderator, Jill Tidman, producer of Happening and executive director of the Redford Center. James Redford, director of Happening and chair of the board, the Redford Center. Emily Kirsch, co-founder and CEO of Powerhouse. Adam Browning, executive director, Vote Solar. Many thanks to our distinguished panel and all their work and their excellent research and documentary and innovations. It's really wonderful to have this panel tonight, and I appreciate all of you being here and sharing with us, especially the way you have shared it and let us know more and more about the clean energy revolution that is growing so rapidly throughout the United States. I'm also very grateful to all of you in our audience who are here tonight, and for those of us, and for those who are on our radio and on our internet. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org/ for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, 230 radio stations on national radio networks, our audio videotapes, as well as free weekly podcasts and archived programs. This is the last program for our Voices for the Environment for fall 2015. We will reopen, so to speak, on January 26, 2016, and join us for our first program, Health and Hope, From the Ocean Depths to the Mountaintops. Learn about two women adventurers and their experiences to protect planet Earth. We hope to see you in January, February, March, next spring. Look for all of our programs on www.commonwealthclub.org. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. First, before we close, let's the audience here give a big hand to the wonderful discussion that we've had tonight from our panel. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion, and I do tell my family I haven't been around the whole 113 years, in the know, is adjourned. Thank you for coming, and thank you for being such a wonderful audience here and on the internet and on the radio.